Blog Talk Radio. Three acclaimed authors we feature tonight will sweep you away to 1800s Paris, to German-controlled World War II Prague, and into the frenzied mind of a woman with bipolar disorder who can't remember whether she murdered her friend. This is the Literary New England Radio Show. I'm your host, Cindy Wolf Boynton, and I hope you'll stay with me for an amazing hour of book giveaways and author interviews as we feature Elizabeth Berg on The Dream Lover, a lush historical novel based on the sensuous life of 19th century writer George Sand. The book is gorgeous in every way. Its cover, pages themselves, and of course the story, which was very much a labor of love. It took Elizabeth more than double the time she generally takes to write a novel, and because she was just so taken with George Sand, it was essential to her to do George justice and tell the story exactly right.
In addition to the research, there was just a lot of thinking about who this person really was, really trying to get at the core of who I think she was and who she loved most in her life.
Susan Crawford, who spent several years living in Boston, is also here. She's the author of The Pocket Wife, a stylish psychological thriller and thrilling exploration of marriage, murder, and a woman on the edge of madness. A woman named Dana, who suffers from bipolar disorder and can't remember whether she might have murdered her friend Celia.
It is about mental illness in as much as I was trying to show a bipolar episode from the inside out. Instead of looking at it from the outside, I was doing my best to show what it might be like to experience it.
We'll start things off with Christy Cambron, author of A Sparrow in Terezin, and just possibly the very nicest and sweetest person I've ever spoken with. A Sparrow in Terezin is the second book in Christy's A Hidden Masterpiece series involving art during the time of the Nazi Holocaust. The story goes back and forth between the past and the present, and it's focused on the lives of two women, but we'll let Christy explain.
A Sparrow in Terezin is the second book in the Hidden Masterpiece series on the art of the Holocaust. The first book in the series, The Butterfly and the Violin, was published last July, and that focused on the art of Auschwitz, and specifically on the women's orchestra of Auschwitz. Now, the second book in the series, we wanted to focus on a lesser-known aspect of World War II, and especially the Holocaust, which is the children's art of the Terezin Ghetto. And not as much as is talked about the Terezin Ghetto, it was really a unique type of concentration camp, if you could even use those words. But in the research that we did, we found that this was not just a concentration camp, but it was also a transport camp. It was a ghetto. It was a place where between the years of 1942 and 1944, some 15,000 children were passed through the Terezin Ghetto, and ultimately fewer than 100 survived the war. Now, what we wanted to
do, oh my gosh.
I mean, really, it's just heartbreaking. And I came across this topic when I was in my undergrad degree research at Indiana University, and we came across not just the art of the Holocaust, but a book entitled I Never Saw Another Butterfly. And this was a book of the children's art of Terezin. And you can imagine how that would stick with you, the images of beautiful watercolor paintings and collages, even some poetry. And then there were some darker images, some images of guards with guns and dogs and watchtowers and, you know, some things that you would think that children would never have to encounter. But this was something that we wanted to pull into the book, and hopefully, because so many of those children are still unnamed to history, those artists are, we wanted to try to bring a voice to that aspect. So That's the setting for the story. Both stories in this series are split contemporary, historical, so there's a contemporary thread as well. With my love for art history, we have a main character, Sarah, who is an art historian and owns a gallery, and she's on a hunt to find the stories of this essentially lost art from the Holocaust.
So these are your first two books, correct?
Yes, these are the first two I have had published, but the 9th and 10th manuscripts that I have written.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Where are the first 8?
The first 3 or 4 are lost on a floppy disk somewhere. You remember those things?
Oh my gosh, yes I do.
Well, I originally started writing in 2001, and it's funny, I was just at a book signing in Bowling Green, Kentucky this past weekend, and someone asked a question of a panel of authors, and we were all speaking, and they said, well, how did you get started in writing? And this was years back, but I was working at a call center. So I worked second and third shift, you know, answering customer service calls for a very large company. And in between calls, sometimes you'd have 30, 45 minutes, maybe even an hour in between calls, and I used to do my homework. And it's interesting because we had a new leader who came in, and she changed the policy, so no reading in between calls, no surfing the internet, no talking. And I remember talking to my husband after that. I said, well, what am I supposed to do in between calls? And I said, you know, she never said I couldn't write. And my husband is always my cheerleader, and he said, let's do it. So we went and we bought a refurbished laptop that had a floppy disk drive, and all it had on it was Word Perfect and Solitaire. Do you remember those systems?
Yeah.
And I wrote my first books, and my mom is the only one who's read those, and I'm sure they were horrible, and they're lost in a drawer somewhere on a floppy disk.
Oh, my God, that's a great story.
Isn't it?
So, yes. So what, I'm just so curious, what got you to the point where you wrote The Butterfly and the Violin, and going into it, did you know that it was going to be a series? And gosh, it's such an important time in history and aspect of life to write about.
Yeah, it really is, and I am honored to be a part of that conversation that hopefully will continue on. Now, my research for this topic and really my introduction to it was in early 2004. So I was a young college student, and I entered an art history class. And I've talked to author friends and, you know, other family members before, and they would always ask me the same question, well, how did you get interested in art history? And it's funny because when I was a child, I had this dream to be a Disney animator. My mom used to take us to the library every week, and instead of going to the fiction, I know this is bad for an author to say, I would go to the art section, and I would sit down in the aisle, and I would pull Disney animation books and art history books from the shelves there, and I would just sit and read them right there in the aisle. And I fell in love with visual storytelling, so I thought, all right, that's what I want to do. But I get to college, and I realize when I'm in these art classes, these studio classes, that I cannot do much that draw stick figures. So I'm going to have to think very quickly about, okay, how am I going to incorporate my love of art with the tools that I have been given? And that's how I came to fall in love with art history. And it was in one of those early art history classes where I first encountered the art of the Holocaust, and I was just captivated from that point on. And you can imagine the classroom, it was dark. Our professor started to project slide images on the front wall, and all of the students, we were very quiet. And looking at the images, it was interesting because we thought they were modern art images on a commentary of the Holocaust. And our professor said, no, actually this is art, prisoner camp art that was created and found after the camps were liberated. And that for me, that almost whispered to my soul, you know, that this was a special topic somehow, that this creation and worshiping, even in worshiping God in the midst of horrific circumstances, that one could still create. And so that was an idea that I had more than 10 years ago. And then got on this road of publication, and my husband and I, in 2011, we decided, okay, we're going to give it a try. We're going to try for publication. I wrote many manuscripts, and I was working with my agent and going to different publishing houses. I also write Regency era, so a lot of the Jane Austen-type novels, write that as well. Write some World War One, a little bit of contemporary. And we finally get to December of 2012, and there is another funny story with how The Butterfly and the Violin, and this story actually came about. We had some work that was being considered at a publisher, and I told my agent at the time, okay, wonderful, if we get a yes, then that means I'm a Regency author, and off we go. And I said, if we get a no, I have this book that I've been thinking about for years on the art of the Holocaust. And when I'm on maternity leave with our third son, I think I want to try to write it, because I was a full-time working mom and I didn't have a lot of time to write. So I knew the only chance I was going to get to write the book was on maternity leave. And so we got a no from the publisher on the Regency work, and I said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to write about the art of Auschwitz. And so that story came alive literally in the middle of the night as I was feeding our newborn son his bottles. I would hold him with one arm and kind of hook him in my elbow, and I would feed him his bottles. And on my right hand, I would type out chapters on my iPhone. And so almost the entire book was written on my phone in the middle of the night.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
And now I like to write on my phone almost all the time. It's my preferred method of writing my first draft.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm really not. And I saved pictures, and I actually have friends at my office in corporate America, because I was traveling so much, and I would always have different meetings, and I worked a job that was very often 60, 70 hours a week, plus three kids, plus writing books. And so the only time I would have is, no kidding, while I'm waiting in the doctor's office or standing in the grocery store line or in elevators, I would type chapters on my phone, wherever I was. Oh, airport lane.
So you wrote it with your thumb?
I did, my right thumb. I should ensure that. I've had people tell me that.
That is absolutely unbelievable. And so now here's a practical question. So does an iPhone has the ability to hold like 90,000 words?
It does. If you go into the notes section, which is what I always do, I just use the generic notes app. It's nothing fancy. It just comes with the phone. You just type your chapter in there, and then I always email it to myself immediately, so I've got it on file. You cut and paste. You drop it into your manuscript. You edit it, and you expand it from there, and then you get a full novel.
And how long did it take you to write this novel on your iPhone?
On The Butterfly and the Violin, that was about 8 weeks, because that's the amount of time that I was on maternity leave. So about 8 weeks. But I'd already done all of the research ahead of time. So it was almost as if the story just was aching after 10 years to be told, and it just kind of poured out of my fingertips. Now, funny.
And what about Sparrow?
Sparrow took a little longer, and I would say here's why. On the very same day that we received the awesome news that we got a first contract with HarperCollins Christian Publishing, an hour later, I got a call from my dad, and he said, this could be bad. I may have leukemia. And we found out, and we went on a five-month journey, that my dad had a very rare and aggressive form of T-cell leukemia. It's called PLL. And he ended up passing away at the end of 2013. And so I wrote A Sparrow and Terezin on the hinges of our family going through this transition period. So it was the first book that my dad wasn't going to get to be a part of, and it was a new journey for me. Literally everything for our family had changed. My dad was a big part of our lives and our children's lives. He was no longer there. We were taking care of my mother. Our family was going through grief. Plus, I had the really great opportunity that now my dream was coming true and I was an author at the same time. So it's kind of an up and down time. And interwoven into the faith thread of this book, the Joshua 1:9 Bible verse that's in there, my dad texted me that verse when he was going through chemo. And the first book, The Butterfly and the Violin, much of that was edited at the local cancer center as he underwent chemo and in the weeks after he passed away. So it took me a little longer to get the story of A Sparrow and Terezin out on paper, out on iPhone, just because our family was going through such a time of transition from the year before.
Now, you keep talking about we.
Yes. We is my husband and I and my family. I am not a lone writer. I'm not a lone author. Every single aspect of this publishing journey has been something that my husband has been my cheerleader. Children have been support systems. My mom is my first reader. It's almost like it's a we, and that's how I think of it. I think I am not just an author. I wish doing this interview that I could have my whole family sitting here with me and we could all answer your questions, because it really is a package deal. So the books that I'm writing, it's not just me.
Well, I think that's very lovely, and I think that's extremely generous. I think any writer will admit very freely that writing is certainly a process that takes the input and advice of many people. How rare is it that you sit down and something is perfect to the first time? It's just not. To be its best, it requires input and feedback from so many different people. But I think that you are being especially generous, and I'm wondering whether it has to do at all with your faith and your involvement in The Grove, which is a storytelling ministry that I'm just fascinated about.
Yeah. Part of it is the Grove, absolutely, in our faith journey. The Grove was something that came alive for us in December of 2014. So I have a group of seven other authors with whom I write this website, and so that is Kara Putman, Catherine Ray, Sarah Ladd, myself, Katie Ganchert, Courtney Walsh, Beth Vogt, and Melissa Tagg. So you can see we have a mixture of historical, contemporary authors. We are all in the Christian publishing industry, and we all have a very deep faith thread to all of the books that we write. But the storytelling ministry came out of this email that we have that we send to each other all the time. For the last year and a half, really, we would send emails of support and how can I pray for you, and really just helping each other along through the industry. A couple of us were brand new authors, and so it was amazing to have these sisters in the Lord, to have these mentors right there willing to pour their experience and willing to share with us in this industry. And we noticed, really independently, but when we came together, we noticed that when we're sharing our stories with readers, you know, you can imagine it's a really intimate thing to write a story and to have one person focus on that story that you're telling. And we found that when we were at book signings or we were at special events where we were speakers, that we had so many readers that identified with our stories to the point they approached us and they wanted to share their story. And we felt like in between those book signings and those events where we're speaking, we wanted to have a really organically grown online community where reader friends, sisters in the Lord, could come and share their story. Because I'm going to be honest, their story is just as important as any story that we publish and we have on a shelf in a bookstore. So that's really where it came from. Kara Putman sent an email in December of 2014 and said, okay, girls, are we going to do this? And we said, let's get together, let's do it. So we started having Google Hangout meetings and these phone calls, you can imagine, full of laughter. And we were really strategic in determining which authors had which skill set and how we were going to build the site and what we wanted it to look like and what the goals were. And we're still growing. We're just 2 months outside of the launch, but we're really excited about the movement that we're seeing and the stories that are being shared there.
And what is the ultimate goal of the site?
Yeah, I think the ultimate goal of the site is to have a community for women, especially. Our target audience is really women in different stages of life. Many of us are married. Some of us are not. Many have children. Some do not. Some are in the industry and have been for quite a while, and some are brand new. And so we want this site to be a place where we not only share encouragement, where we share our faith, but that women have a place to come. So if they have an incident in life where maybe they don't have support. So my example is when my father was diagnosed with leukemia and was in ICU for almost 2 weeks, and our family was going through that, I had a deeply rooted community in my church, in our family. There's some women that do not have that, and we want to provide that on-the-spot support whenever that woman is going through a difficult time in life, and it can be any number of circumstances. She may not have a support system, and she may feel more comfortable coming to an online community where she knows she's going to be embraced, prayed for, lifted up, and encouraged. So that's really our vision, and it could evolve, you know, as we continue on, but that's where the vision began.
That's really magnificent. And I'm curious, I'm wondering, can you define Christian literature, or at least how your books fit into the Christian literature genre? Because I think that there is a misconception that unless you are a devout Christian, you can't enjoy Christian literature, and I don't think that's true at all.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. Initially, when I got into the publishing industry, the space that I really wished to be in was to uplift my sisters and brothers in the Lord, those who already have faith, but also to connect with those who may not identify with my same faith. And I really believe that came out of my undergrad experience at Indiana University and really researching art history. You can imagine all of the different cultures and all of the different faiths that I learned about. I never had to check my faith at the door when I came into a classroom to appreciate, to respect, to understand a variance of backgrounds and faiths. And so what I would love for readers to get out of these books is, yes, I am going to have a faith thread in there. the other distinguishing aspect of the Christian publishing industry is that there are aspects of the book that will be very clean, meaning I don't have any language in the book, I don't have any explicit scenes between men and women. Those types of things will not be in any fiction that are in the Christian industry. There are some other publishers who, for whatever line they have of books that they're publishing, that may have more of a softer, more gentle, inspirational thread, and those books are really in a different category than the books that I have here, because my books do tackle a little bit of a grittier topic. I'm really interested in those stories of hope, those stories of redemption that can come from dark places. So not only concentration camps, which is what these first two books are, but then the next books that I'm writing on 1920s jazz age entertainers, I'm really excited to get to dig deep into some of these aspects again of maybe darker places in our country's history and find hope and a Christian faith thread throughout those. So the first book is on...
Oh,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you just beat me to my next question. No, but go ahead, please tell me your next book.
The book that I'm actually writing right now, and I'm working with the Ringling Museum in Sarasota, Florida. The first book will be on John and Mabel Ringling and the early circus in the 1920s of America. And then the next book in the series, I'm so excited, is about Harry Houdini. So I get the opportunity to kind of dive into these areas of our country's history. You know, you think about the circus and you think about this really diverse secondary cast of characters that you can dream up in these books, and then also to get to research vaudeville and what was happening socially and what was happening post-World War I. And then you get the art aspect in there as well, and these really vibrant, colorful topics. I mean, it's just like it's serving an author the most awesome opportunity to have a topic like that. So I'm excited to move on. And these are Christian books as well, but I love that my publisher is asking me to kind of go there to push and stretch myself a little bit as an artist and really try to write this hope, this faith thread in these type of tough topics.
I love that, Christy. And now, so what happens with the Holocaust? Are you done with the Holocaust art books?
The first two books in the series, yes. We currently do not have plans for a third. However, you never know what can happen in the future. So I think when readers get to the second book in the series, I wanted as a reader, what I always want when I'm reading, is to be satisfied with the conclusion of the story. So I've left a few things open just in case we decide to revisit this topic, but for right now, the second book in the series will be the final book for the Hidden Masterpiece.
And what's your timeline for the Jazz Age Entertainer series?
We currently don't have a title yet, and we don't have a release date, though I know the Ringling book, the circus book, will be out in 2016, and we're targeting 2017 for the Harry Houdini book. And then after that, I have several other ideas, and I'll get together with my agent, and we will see what books we'll be writing after that.
That's so incredibly exciting, and that's fast.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And so are you currently, when we hang up, are you going to go write on your iPhone?
I have my iPhone right next to me. And in fact, I have a funny story about that, too. I had a really old iPhone, an iPhone 4, and it was kaput. You know, you write a couple novels on it, and it's kind of used up. I went to the cell phone store just a couple of days ago, and I walked in, and I said, okay, I know exactly what I want. I said, I want a small cell phone so I can write a book in my hand. And they just kind of looked at me, and I had to explain myself. I said, no, I don't want one of the big, nice, new screens. I need one of your old phones because it's the only ones that are small enough to fit in my hand. So, yes, as soon as we get off the phone, I will go work on writing my next book.
Oh, my goodness. You're amazing. You truly are amazing.
Well, thank you. Again, it came out of necessity of being a busy corporate mom. And I think now sometimes you develop these habits and they just kind of die hard.
So, A Sparrow in Terezin. Did I say that right, Terezin?
Yes.
Do you have to read The Butterfly and the Violin first?
That's a great question, and I have had readers ask before, and I would say no. It's a standalone novel. It does have connections in the contemporary storyline to the first book, so I really think that readers would probably enjoy following Sarah's story through the two books. But if they did choose to want to focus on the Terezin storyline, the book is standalone. And I do also have a recommendation for parents who may be interested in having their younger adolescent children read this book. I do recommend that if you have a mature 7th or 8th grade child, that this book would be appropriate for that audience and above.
That's very good to know. And I need to wrap things up. We've talked actually over our time limit, but you are so very interesting. I don't want to hang up from you, and you have such great, great energy. I'm curious, you know, I've talked with so many authors over the past few years that the Literary New England Radio Show has been on the air. I've spoken with people who had one, two, even three books that were in a draw or thrown away. I have never met anyone before who had eight books that were not published, yet you just kept persevering.
Kept going. We had so many rejections that I finally stopped counting, and my husband and I chose to not see it as a no. We would say it's a not yet or a not here. Every publisher, not yet, not here. We know we're going to find our publishing home. And to tell you the truth, a year later, one of those not yets, one of those rejections we had, became my publishing home.
Oh, my goodness.
Keep going. Keep going, writers.
That's amazing. Christy, just a pleasure to talk with you today.
Wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for having me.
One of Christy's inspirations for becoming a fiction writer came right here from New England, from Massachusetts. And I'm sure many of you listening have been inspired by this classic author, too. Tell me, Christy, who is this author again?
Louisa May Alcott. One of the reasons why I wanted to get into fiction writing was, and it wasn't until I was in my 20s, but I started reading a lot of classic literature, and I mean, some of them are English. You know, I love Jane Austen, and I love the Bronte sisters, and Gaskell, and all of that, but also love Louisa May Alcott.
If you'd like to see the results of Louisa May Alcott's inspiration on Christy, you can win a copy of A Sparrow in Terezin by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. When Elizabeth Berg was 9, she submitted her very first poem to American Girl magazine. It was rejected. 25 years passed before she submitted another piece of her writing again, and today she is a multi-time New York Times best-selling author, with her latest novel, The Dream Lover, causing so much buzz that all I can say is, wow. In fact, I think some of the buzz is ringing in my ears right now. At the same time that she and I started talking, I was trying to count the number book The Dream Lover is for her.
I think it's her 20th novel. I'd have to tell myself that I believe it is.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's kind of a milestone if it is 20.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling about this book?
How am I feeling about it? Oh, I am really happy. I'm really happy. The books I've written before this and the novels have been so easy, and this one was really hard. So it feels great to be finished with it and to see it looking so beautiful. I think the jacket is stunning. I think the end papers are stunning. I think the cut pages are stunning. And it was in the middle of it, I wanted to quit. I just wanted to throw in the towel. It's just too hard to do. But largely because of my editor, I persevered, and I'm so glad I did. I really love this book. My favorite book of all of mine is my first novel, and I think that will always be true. But this is the one I'm most proud of, so I'm thrilled that it's out.
It is absolutely a gorgeous book to look at, to hold. You're right, the cover is just beyond gorgeous. What was it about this book that made it so hard for you? And why were the other ones easy, Elizabeth?
The other books were contemporary novels, and I'm not a writer who plots. I just make it up as I go along. That's the joy in writing for me, is to see what's discovered every day. This book required massive amounts of research, first of all, which I had not ever done before. And then it became difficult structurally, because I had at first written it in a linear fashion, chronologically, and then my editor wanted to bring some of the later scenes in Paris up closer to the front of the book. And I was trying to think, how do you do that and not have it
sort of stick out that you're moving this scene up, and does it even make sense to move a scene that occurs that much later up? And finally, I spread the whole manuscript out on my dining room table and began alternating the past and the present in a way that made sense to me intuitively and practically. I think that all of us at certain times of probably every day harken back to other times in our life, oftentimes to our childhood, because who we are as children makes us the adult we become. And it's always there. So when you read this book and you read a scene that occurred during their childhood, it helps explain what follows. So I felt that the scenes worked hand in hand in that respect.
So what made you decide to take on such a large and very different project? Because you could have easily just stuck with writing contemporary fiction, and probably anything you wrote would be great, and you have a huge legion of fans, but instead you decided to do something totally different.
Yeah, you know, I often say that you don't find books all the time, they can find you. The same goes for subjects. And what happened with this one is, you may be familiar with The Writer's Almanac, which is a daily email that comes from Garrison Keillor. On it, there's always a really good poem and then a whole bunch of facts having in some way or another to do with things literary, including sometimes authors' birthdays. Today is the birthday of. So one day, it was the birthday of George Sand. And I knew nothing about her other than she was a 19th century French writer. That's all I knew. Oh, yeah, and that she killed Chopin, which actually is not true that she killed Chopin. She probably kept him alive much longer than he would have lived otherwise. Nonetheless, I read these interesting facts about her, and they painted a kind of portrait of a woman full of contrast and contradiction, and that really interests me. I like people that complex. If you went to a party and sat next to someone who said, yeah, my father was an aristocrat, but my mother was a prostitute, I mean, you'd have to send someone else out to get the hors d'oeuvres for you, because this would be a pretty fascinating person. So she was full of contrast, and I wanted to read a novel about her. I like novels. In addition to biography, I like novels because they offer the author latitude to create scenes, to put in dialogue, to take flight and make up things that didn't happen but seemed as though they could have. I find that very colorful and interesting. So I went to see how many novels there were about her and which one I would pick, and there weren't any. So I thought, I'll fix this. I'll call Nancy Horan, who's a friend of mine. She wrote Loving Frank.
Yes, love the book, yes.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. And I thought she would be the perfect person to write a novel about George Sand. So I called her and said, Nancy, you have to write a novel about George Sand. And she said, I'm not writing anything. I'm exhausted. I just finished Under the Widened Star Sky. You write it. So I thought, first I said, I can't write a book like that. That's not, you know, I don't write books like that. And she said, oh, of course you can. It'll be wonderful. So, you know, with that little encouraging start, I said, okay, I'll try.
That's amazing. So how long ago was that, Elizabeth?
It took me 2 years, which for me is a very long time. It takes me about half an hour to write a novel, usually. And this one took longer. And in addition to the research, there was just a lot of thinking about who this person really was, really trying to get at the core of who I think she was and who she loved most in her life and the trajectory of her whole life. I wanted to do her whole life because some parts of it are so tragic, and she had a lot of tragic love affairs, but in the end, her life was just a glorious triumph. I also was taken with her writing. You have to read her novels, and indeed this book, understanding that this takes place in the age of Romanticism, where sentimentality and intuition and intense emotion were really prized. So some of her novels are purple prose-ish, but her nonfiction, including her 1,000-plus page autobiography are fascinating and beautifully written. She had a very lucid style, and she wrote effortlessly. She would fill 20 pages at a time, as opposed to her pal Flaubert, who worried about every sentence.
You know what? You're so interesting. You decide to write this totally different type of novel, and then instead of just focusing on one aspect of her life, it's like, oh, let's write about her entire life.
Ignorance is bliss, right?
I guess so. Well, clearly you've done something right, however, because everybody I know wants to read this book.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And everybody online is talking about it. I don't know what book website you can go to where someone isn't talking about The Dream Lover and just how magnificent it is. I mean, you must know that, right?
I can't tell you how gratifying it is to hear that, because it really was a hard book to write. And I sat around in my bathrobe in despair on more than one day. So I did a reading last night and said, you know, this is my reward, that I get to stand up here in front of you and read passages from this book on which I labored so hard, and to feel that you are feeling it, because they really did. And it's so rewarding.
So was there something in particular about George Sand that you want people to know about or understand?
Yes, and that is that I think she is misperceived as being a really strong woman. In some respects she was, but she was incredibly vulnerable. And she said about herself, the only thing strong about me is my need to love. Her whole life was a search for love, with good reason, because of what her childhood was like and what her experiences with love relationships were. And the best thing for me as a woman of a certain age was coming to see how much she embraced getting older. She loved getting older. She ended up being the happiest that she ever was when she became old. She had more energy. She could see better. She wrote little stories for her grandchildren. She sewed costumes for her son Maurice's puppets, for his magnificent puppet theater. She came to a kind of genuine and honest reconciliation with the vagaries of life, and just achieved a deep content and was sustained by a deep faith. And it was, this sounds so weird. I get goosebumps talking about this. I'm so inspired by that.
And I can hear that. I can really hear awe.
Yeah, I just adore her. And it's hard for me to think that anyone who reads about George Sand in an open way and a thorough way wouldn't come to the same conclusion. So I'm happy to bring her up and to suggest that people read her work and become acquainted with her as a realer version, in my opinion, of herself than she has been portrayed thus far.
And were you able to take a field trip to Paris?
I purposely did not. I've been to Paris a few times, and I purposely did not, nor did I go to Nantes. The reason is that I wanted to preserve it in my mind the way that I believe it was. And if I went there now, the Paris now is so very different from the Paris she lived in the 1830s. And it was such a more compact city, of course. You could walk all over the city. And people's manners and ways of dressing, I just wanted to be there in my mind and not have it contrasted with the way it is now. If I went to Nantes and there was a tour bus and T-shirts and jeans and there were lavatories, it would ruin it. Now that I've finished the book, though, I'm dying to go to Nantes.
Oh, I don't blame you. I hope you get there.
I do too.
And you are going to a lot of wonderful other places, right? You have a great book tour in the U.S., which,
yes,
among other places, on May 7th is going to bring you to Newtonville Books, which we just love, in Newton Center, Massachusetts. Do you enjoy interacting with your fans, Elizabeth?
Very much so. Yeah. They tell me things about what my books have meant to them that I just kind of take home that night and review, you know, little Valentines, invisible Valentines. Yeah, I really do enjoy it. And, you know, the thing about touring is no one's going to come up and say, I really hated your book, you.
No.
So they come up and say, you know, what they loved about it. And they, or they say, I'm so excited to read this. And, yeah, it's wonderful. Plus, you get room service, you know.
And what's better than that?
Nothing.
And you have a lovely blog site, which is elizabeth-berg.net. And now we see this adorable dog here, and we see flowers and a couch and a fireplace. Do any of those actually belong to you?
No, but that's my idea of a good time, a roaring fire, a place to read, and a dog nearby. I liked doing that blog, and then a lot because of my publisher, I went on Facebook, so most of the, quote, blogging takes place there now these days. I write on Facebook more than I do on that blog, but that's all preserved on the website. The website is used also to put the tour stops on, so the entire tour is there and nowhere else, so I'm glad to have that website.
Oh yes, and it's very user-friendly as well. Elizabeth, we need to wrap things up, but do you have a pitch for The Dream Lover?
Oh, well, it's a book for those who thought they knew George Sand to read.
And what if you've never heard of George Sand?
The Dream Lover will convince you that she's worth knowing.
I love it. I just love it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Elizabeth and I talked about these dates, but I'll mention them again. Next week on Wednesday, May 6th, she'll be at Wellesley Books on Central Street in Wellesley, Massachusetts at 7 p.m. The following night, Thursday, May 7th, she'll be at Newtonville Books on Langley Road in Newton Center. That event will also begin at 7 p.m., and it will be a joint appearance with Patricia Bracewell, author of the newly released The Price of Blood. If you don't want to wait until then to get a copy of The Dream Lover, I have one for you. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of the critically acclaimed The Pocket Wife by Susan Crawford, who on her blog describes the novel as being about a woman losing control. Its protagonist, Dana, has been marginalized, invalidated. She also suffers from mental illness, and views of herself and the world are beginning to blur.
The main character is bipolar, and she is, for a number of reasons, not in a good place mentally. Her son has just gone off to college, and her husband's acting strangely, and she is off her medication. She has an argument and does far too much drinking with her neighbor, and goes sort of stumbles home, doesn't really remember much after the drinking and the arguing, and she wakes up to an ambulance in the neighborhood, and it pulls up in front of her neighbor's house. And she runs down and finds, to her horror, that the neighbor has been murdered. That's the beginning. And so she's not sure how much, if anything, she had to do with the death of her neighbor. So throughout the book, she is trying to bring back her memories of that day and to prove to herself that she had nothing to do with the neighbor's death, but it does look like she was the last person to see the neighbor alive. And the detective, Jack Moss, who's working on the case, has a tangential involvement because his son was in the GED class taught by the dead woman.
So is this a novel about mental illness? Is this a novel about mystery? Is this a novel about murder? How would you define this novel, or is it indefinable?
It's a little bit of all of those things. Not so much the murder, because the murder has already taken place. I don't do Gore very well, so she's already dead. But it is about mental illness in as much as I was trying to show a bipolar episode from the inside out. Instead of looking at it from the outside, I was doing my best to show what it might be like to experience it and looking out at the world instead of the world looking in.
And so now maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself as well as where this story came from, because you are someone who's worked for several years and has had a career, and writing is, or at least being published as a writer, is something new to you.
It is. Writing isn't new to me. I think I came out of the womb writing, but being a published author is new. I won some contests here and there, but I was a teacher for many years in various adult education settings. Most recently, I taught for the UAW at their skill center at General Motors. I taught there for 10 years till the plant closed, and I did that through DeKalb Technical College, so I continued working, substituting for them. And I also assessed the GED essays for the state of Georgia. I did that for many years, too. So sort of cobbled my jobs together, two part-time jobs, or three, tutoring sometimes. I have three daughters who were raised here in Atlanta area. And I joined a novel critique group a few years ago. I just happened to mention at work my daughters were grown out of the house, and I thought, well, now maybe I'm going to spend a little more time with my writing and seeing about publishing. And so I just asked at work, does anybody know of a critique group? And somebody did, and I joined it, and I started submitting my work there. It was really fun, very supportive group. And when I first started there, there were mostly women, and then it was sort of even, and then it morphed into mostly men, and well, all men at one point, and me. And they complained constantly that my characters weren't actually doing anything. They just sort of wandered around and talked and drank tea, and why don't you have more action, more action. So I said, okay, fine, the next book is going to start out with a dead body, and it did. And that was how the Pocket Wife came to be. And then I found that it was really fun. I really, really enjoyed writing the book. I really enjoyed writing the character, or trying to write the character. And it was a challenge.
And you got great reviews, though.
I did.
You've published now a book that's getting fabulous reviews that all kinds of people are talking about, and I can only imagine how that must feel for you.
Well, it's a little surreal. I submitted the book when the book was, I thought it was finished. I had it originally, it was from several points of view, and I submitted it at a writer's conference here to Jenny Bent, great agent, and she liked it, but she said, maybe just the one point of view, possibly two. So I went back and wrote it differently. And then there was a lot of waiting, and then a lot of, well, maybe change this, and a lot of maybe change that. And then I finished it, turned it in to her in the middle of the night, and the next, I think it was the next day, there was an offer on the book. So it was a lot of waiting, a lot of rewriting, a lot of doing other things while I was working on the book, and then suddenly everything happened at once.
How exciting.
It was very exciting, and the book went to auction, and it was just very, all these iconic people I was talking to on the phone, it was just very, very exciting.
And I love the cover. For anyone who hasn't seen the cover, it is this woman who has very pale, lush skin. skin, and she has these bright red lips. You don't see her nose or her eyes, but the top of the cover starts with these just vibrant red lips with her red fingernail up to it. And I don't know if I want to kiss those lips, pull her hand away, what I want to do. But it's a cover that just makes you go, whoa.
It's a great cover. They really, yeah, HarperCollins has a great marketing and art department, and I just love that cover. I think it's very eye-catching. And what people seem to love to do was actually the idea of a friend of mine, and I did it originally. She said, well, why don't you hold the book up to the bottom half of your face? And so I did, and then I posted the picture on Facebook or something, and people are doing that a lot. In fact, we had a contest recently who looks the most like the model, or who, you know, who's the funniest or whatever. It's still kind of up in the air, I guess, that part of it. But people seem to love to do that because it does almost match up with an actual face.
It does. That's hysterical. I love that.
Yeah.
So now, Susan, do you have bipolar, or does someone you love have bipolar? Is that part of where this book came from?
I don't. No, I don't. But I have had people in my life that I was very close to that did, and I tried my best to put it across as to make the person who had this illness a believable character, and so that people might have a little more awareness or a little more empathy or sympathy or something for people with bipolar disorder.
Sure. Well, one of the reasons of me asking that question is, you know, was there a secondary reason for this particular storyline, and did it have something to do with educating people about this condition?
Well, I've always had an interest in psychology, and I studied it in college extensively. I have half a master's in counseling. So clearly my interest lies in psychology and in people and the way they sort of bounce off, well, the way we sort of bounce off each other, and actions and reactions. I don't think I was trying to educate, because I don't feel qualified at all to educate about bipolar disorder or any other mental illness.
Maybe you just wanted to write a great book.
I just wanted to write a book whose characters interested me, because I think if I'm not interested in the characters, then it's really difficult for me to write about them.
That makes perfect sense.
So I thought Dana was an interesting character. She's not a particularly likable or lovable character at all, but she was interesting to write. She was interesting to try to put across.
So now tell us about your website. You have a very sassy-looking website that people can go and learn about more about you. What's that address?
It is SusanCrawfordNovelist.com.
There's quite a few Susan Crawfords out there.
That's why it's sort of an obscure... the novelist, I don't know if people would find it very easily. But I tried everything. Susan Crawford, Susan H. Crawford, Susan this, and Susan Crawford author. And so going down the line, I ended up with Susan Crawford novelist.
I think that's a good choice. And are you interested in speaking with book clubs via Skype or conference call or in person?
Oh, I am very much. In fact, I'm not quite sure how to get started doing that. I've been promising friends that I would come and talk at their book clubs, but of course that's around here, and that's probably a handful of people. But yes, I'm very interested.
Wonderful. So people can reach out to you via your website, and you're also on Facebook and Twitter?
I am. Oh yeah, Twitter, it's Crawford Susan H. So my name in reverse.
And you're Susan Crawford author on Facebook.
Right.
Wonderful. So we need to wrap things up, but what is your pitch for the book? Why should someone consider picking it up?
Well, there's the cover.
There's the one, and the contest, or just to have a good time, put their nose on top of it.
There you are, yeah. It is a suspense. It's being categorized as a literary suspense or thriller. So it is a suspense, and there is a mystery, and there is a, I wonder who did it element. But there, I think it goes pretty deeply into, well, not deeply, but it deals a lot with the characters, the individual characters. And each of the characters has a reason for doing exactly, again, they're not, none of them are particularly lovable characters, but each of them has a reason for doing what he or she does in the book.
Susan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
There's still time to tweet or email us to win all of the titles we featured tonight. Our Twitter handle is at LitNewEngland, and our email address is LitNewEngland@gmail.com. We'll take entries for just a few more minutes as I say thank you and good night to our wonderful guests. Thank you so much to Elizabeth Berg, Christy Cambron, and Susan Crawford. Thanks so much to all of you also for listening. If you missed any part of tonight's show, you can listen to it in its entirety in the Literary New England Radio Show Archives, where all of the 132 episodes we've aired since December 2011 are available. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back again next Monday, and we hope that you will too. Between now and then, I hope you'll find the time to pop over to our website, www.litnewengland.com, to see what we've got going on. We also have an amazing tweet chat coming up this Thursday night. From 8 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 30th, we'll be talking on Twitter with historical novelists Erica Roebuck about her new novel, The House of Hawthorne, and to Sarah McCoy about The Map Maker's Children. I can't wait to talk with these lovely ladies and hope you'll join us, because in addition to the fact that they are both so talented and really just such fun tweeters, we'll be giving away copies of both of their books. To join us, you want to use the LNE chat hashtag. That's #LNEchat, one word. Again, the time is 8 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 30th. I hope to see you there. Thanks again for being here tonight. Have a great week and great reading.